Okay, item 10, and let's see. Mic is on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today, at the board's request, we have a workshop to discuss the active death benefit. We do have in your packet a slideshow, slides that go over some of the basic and more complex items that have to do with this benefit. You have a copy of the current active benefit form, the disability application policy, as well as memos from the board's fiduciary counsel, Harvey Lederman, who has advised the board over the years regarding this benefit. I have Tim Hockey here, who's our retirement services manager, and they handle disabilities. And so Tim will go over some of the benefit calculations, amounts, and statistical information about how many active death cases we've had here. We do have Harvey Lederman here, who is the board's outside fiduciary counsel, and he's here to assist the board and discuss his benefit from a fiduciary perspective. And we're also fortunate this morning to have Dr. Blank here. Dr. Robert Blank, as you know, is Sisera's outside medical advisor. He is the medical director and CEO of Worksite Partners Medical Group, and he's an occupational medicine physician consultant. He'll be addressing from the medical perspective what he's seeing in these cases in terms of disability and death. And so we're going to start with slide number one, and we'll cover some of the basic concepts first, and that is that SARA members who are permanently incapacitated may be entitled to disability retirement. The law does tell us when a disability application can be made, and generally it can be made any time while the member is in service or within 4 months after the member's discontinuance of service. There are two types of disability retirement with SARA. One is a service-connected disability retirement, and the other one is non-service-connected disability retirement. For today's discussion, we really only focus on the non-service-connected disability retirement. That is what this process is all about. The active death benefit form that we use in the process has to do with non-service-connected disability retirement. So the disability retirement, permanent incapacity for the performance of duty, shall in all cases be determined by the retirement board. That comes from Government Code Section 31725 in the SIRL. It's important to keep in mind only the board determination. And in making that determination, the board may require proof, including a medical examination of the member, any proof that the board deems necessary to determine the existence of the disability. The evidence that goes to showing the disability has to be competent medical evidence, and that's in the law. SARA requires the submission of medical reports supporting the disability application. That requirement is found in the disability policy, and so an application won't be accepted by SARA unless it's supported by medical reports. And this is a list of the types of medical evidence that we see. Medical reports about the illnesses, injuries, or conditions that the member has suffered. The reports will address, hopefully, when the condition began and how the condition limits the member's activities, what medical tests show, what medical treatment was received, and generally the member's work restrictions that are caused by the condition. In cases of death, where the member unfortunately dies while the application is pending, we do look to the death certificate and any coroner report that address the cause of death. And if the member is seeking a service-connected disability, they must also provide evidence supporting service connection. It's important to remember that the burden of proof is with the applicant, or if the applicant is deceased, it's on the beneficiaries. An applicant must prove the existence of permanent incapacity by preponderance of the evidence. There has to be substantial evidence, and the courts have stated that substantial means anything credible and of solid value. When the disability application file is complete with CSERA, CSERA staff will provide all the documentation to the board's medical advisor for review. The medical advisor makes a preliminary recommendation to the board. That recommendation summarizes the evidence or the absence of evidence supporting the recommendation. If the medical advisor's preliminary recommendation is to grant the application, the matter is then placed on the agenda for the board's consideration of the recommendation. If the medical advisor cannot recommend granting the application based on the evidence submitted, CSERA staff advises the applicant that she or he may either submit additional medical or other evidence in support of the application, and that will then get transmitted to the medical advisor for additional review, or they may request a hearing, an administrative hearing before a hearing officer within 6 months of the date of the letter informing the member that the medical advisor is unable to recommend granting the application. And that administrative hearing is an important process in the disability application process because it is providing the applicant with due process. They, through that process, they have notice and an opportunity to present their case before an administrative law judge, and then their, the administrative law judge's recommendation and finding of facts will then be presented to the board for the board's final decision. Now we turn to a case that was published in 1966 by the California Supreme Court. We talked about this case, I believe, last year in April when the board had a discussion about this topic. The case is called Gorman versus Cranson. And in that case, the member was happened to be a judge, and he was a member of the judge's retirement system. He had signed an advance consent form seeking disability retirement prior to him undergoing surgery. He signed the consent, left the date blank on the consent, and he asked his son to mail it to the retirement system in case he dies or becomes disabled. And so then the member underwent surgery. Came out of surgery appearing to be in good shape, but then he suddenly lapsed into a coma resulting from cerebral hemorrhage, and he died without having regained consciousness. The consent form that he signed but didn't date was then dated, and it was identified on the form who his physician was, and the physician included an attestation that the member was disabled prior to death. That was then sent to the retirement system, and the retirement system paused and wasn't sure whether this was a valid way of making an application because it was made before the disability of the member started. The Supreme Court held in favor of the judge's widow, so the member's widow, and she sought survivor benefits based on her late husband's disability retirement. She said that essentially he was in retired status as a disabled retired member, and she should be receiving the applicable benefits. The Supreme Court, yes.
To the problem I've had with this all along. Did the court look at his disability starting at the time he underwent surgery, he lapsed into a coma, they deemed the doctors, you know, attesting, is his disability started at that from that time going forward? They didn't specifically say because he ended up being dead, he was disabled. Correct. And so through this whole discussion, and Dr. Blank, just so you know where I'm coming from, the challenge I'm having with our policy as we go through this discussion is that there are some instances where someone appears to pretty much instantly die or die within a matter of seconds. And so I'm having a hard time finding any instance where we would not, under those circumstances, or under sort of this standard, be able to say, it just because you're dead, you're disabled. And you died instantly, so you're disabled. So in essence, every single member would be entitled to this because there's no discernible witness in most of our instances, someone saying he was disabled and then he died. These are usually where someone is discovered deceased. And that's sort of where I'm having the problem. So I just wanted to clarify, while this is very helpful information to me, I just want to make sure that as I read the excerpts from the case, the court was really relying upon the fact that clearly the judge was ill. It necessitated surgery. Prior to him going into surgery, he executed this form. And in fact, as he exited, even though he was still alive after surgery, he clearly, you know, died. But there was this very discernible period in which he was disabled. And that's where I'm having the hard part is, what constitutes a reasonable, discernible period? Because otherwise we're talking nanoseconds. And Doctor, in previous discussions, we even gave the example of someone getting shot in the head. And, you know, as a horrible example as it is, you know, walking out of a meeting, someone comes up, shoots him in the head. Were they disabled for just these seconds as the bullet entered their brain and they had this moment in which they were brain dead, but maybe their body had a disease? So that's where I'm really having the hard time with this policy of us coming up with what constitutes a discernible period of disability. Otherwise, we need to almost say, you're entitled to this when you die, because clearly you're disabled at the moment you you die. You can't work anymore. So anyway, sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to make sure I had that clarified from the court's decision.
And Candace, speaking to that, I don't know if you've been able to read all the materials. They actually do give examples later on of someone who takes like a shotgun slug to their heart, someone who falls out of a 20-story building, someone who gets hit by a bus or a train. Those are instantaneous deaths, according to the materials, which I'm sure you're going to get to. But and they gave explanation of things that where you are still alive, even if you have had a heart attack. So, you know, I think Karen's going to speak to those concerns later.
I did read the materials, but I really wanted to focus on, because we're relying on a court's decision, I just want to clarify what that decision actually was speaking to.
Yes, and that decision, I'm not sure that the court really looked at the time prior to him signing the letter, the advance consent letter, and prior to surgery. They don't specify exactly the duration of the disability, but they do mention minutes and maybe hours of disability. I'm pretty sure that the disability went to the time that he was in a coma until he died, or it may have started when he underwent the surgery. I'm not sure. They're not specific about that point. But you're right, Candace, in that case is somewhat distinguishable factually from some of the cases that you've looked at where it did seem to be an instantaneous death, like a cardiac arrest, and things of that nature. And so later on, we're going to be talking about the definition of death, and we're going to let Dr. Blank address what happens medically when someone is disabled prior to death, when there's an instantaneous death, when there is a death that is not instantaneous, where there's a disability that was going on for maybe minutes or hours prior to death.
Just to be real clear on the issue, there's no suggestion in that case or in Cesare's practices that the death is the disability.
Right.
It's the period of time when one is disabled before death, and you're focused on the discernible period of time, if there is such a thing. But just to be clear, no one is suggesting that death itself constitutes the disability on which a benefit can be granted. It really comes down to what is a discernible period, and we're fortunate to have Dr. Blink help us with that this morning.
Scott, did you still want to speak?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify something. I agree with everything Candace said, and I want to get clear on this. The case, but there's a little typo, this is actually Alan Cranston. Raise your hand if you remember, actually remember who Alan Cranston was. There you go. All right.
Broke up the Eagles.
So, the case isn't being cited for the proposition of instantaneous death, right? I mean, that's not why it's cited here. Because, I want to get a response to that. The case isn't cited in these materials for the proposition that instantaneous death qualifies as a disability. Am I correct? Okay. So, how I read this case was that the court was kind of working through a process. This many years ago, it looks like a 66 case, which we now have embodied in a policy that has rules and procedures that if followed, end up in the same place that the widow did in the Cranston case, right? Correct?
Correct.
So the reference in the case to minutes is the court's observation. This is the way I took it. That's the court's observation that there was some discernible period of time that the court concluded that the judge was disabled because as a result of the post-surgery complication, he was disabled before he died, right? Can we agree on that? Okay, so I just want to be sure what we're doing. I think the conundrum for me, just like it is for Candace, is the fiction that we have to engage in, at least that's my view, that's my term, the fiction we have to engage in to determine that someone was disabled within the meaning of the policy to qualify for the benefit in the case of instantaneous death. And I'll be very interested to hear Dr. Blink's take on this. But that's where the rubber meets the road for me. That's the issue that has hung us up. Otherwise, I get it. It's not an issue. If someone's disabled before they die, they qualify for the benefit. Understood. It's our policy. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
My reading of the case, in my opinion, the judges, the court really focused more on the process of pre-signing something before the condition subsequent happens, before the disability actually happens. That is really the key issue in the case here that the court is struggling with. The disability part of whether he was disabled prior to death, they explain that in sort of a summary way. They don't really get into too many questions or issues with that. They kind of take for granted. They cite it as there was a physician that included an attestation that the member was disabled prior to death, and that was it. That's not really, in my mind, the key issue that the judges were looking at here. The key issue was this election signed by the member before the condition subsequent, meaning the disability, actually happened. That's what gave the retirement system pause here about allowing this process, because they said, well, he wasn't disabled when he signed the form.
Right.
That's really what the case was about.
Right. It's actually the court working through what we have embodied in a policy now. It's almost as if they were applying, sort of trying to discern the testator's intent kind of approach to try to figure out if it was okay to pre-decide you're going to do this or to authorize a family member, spouse, to sign in your stead and so forth. What we now have is a pre-signed arrangement. You know, the members' election far in advance this is a case of first impression, right? This was a novel issue presented to the court, and they worked through it and got, I think, to the right result on these facts, at least in my opinion. So I view the reference to the duration as being picked up, at best. It's not part of the rationale of the holding at all, right? It's just a discussion about there was a period of time that the judge was alive before he passed away. Right?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay, all right.
And so the court went on to explain that by the mere signing of an advance consent, a member will have been deemed to have retired for disability at the time he or she became disabled, even if for minutes before death. And the court rejected the argument that accepting the disability application in this case would authorize a disability benefit in almost every instance. And now we move on to CICERA's form and process. And the purpose of the form that CICERA has is to for the member to authorize CICERA to file an application for non-service-connected disability on the member's behalf in the event that the member is permanently incapacitated by reason of injury or other disability leading to death while the member is an active member of CICERA. The form allows the member to pre-select an optional settlement pursuant to CERL Section 317.62 or 64. In the form, there is a member acknowledgement that they have to sign off on that if the non-service-connected disability is granted by the board, this will entitle the beneficiaries to receive a non-service-connected disability retirement survivor continuance under optional settlement 2 or 4. The member must be eligible to apply for a non-service-connected disability, what we call vested. The member has to be vested at the time, which means that they have to have either 5 or 10 years of service, depending on their tier, to be able to qualify. In 2011, the board held a meeting regarding this issue and took some recommendation from the board's fiduciary counsel, Harvey Lederman, who's here today. And based on those, the process was revised. The form itself was revised. The process was clarified to include a board determination on whether to grant a non-service-connected disability. And that the forms that were already on file with CICERA should be honored, but a formal non-service-connected disability application must be filed in each case, and that the system regularly advise members, active members, about their choices in this regard. So that's the form, and now we're going to turn over to death benefits. So if someone...
John, is there any disadvantage to the member in signing the form in advance?
In some situations, we found that the benefit to the beneficiary might be lower if the form was signed. But those situations are not common. So generally, the benefits would increase if the form is signed.
It just strikes me as we go through this, that if it's a practical matter, it's universal if the individual benefits. Why not make it automatic? Why go through all the form process? Is that part of what we've looked at in the past and decided to stick with the form?
There is a legal requirement that optional settlement elections be made in writing. So we have to have that in writing.
Couldn't you make one optional form automatic unless somebody in writing has changed that so that...
We're unable to do that because the statute requires a written election by the member to opt into the optional settlements.
And that election can be changed all the way up to the first day of retirement by the member. So we can't truncate that process and remove from the member the option to go from option 1 to option 2, option 4.
It just strikes me that we're setting ourselves up in this process to have somebody who failed to realize all that and didn't have a form where their counterpart did, and their errors have at least some case, whether it's a good one or not, to come back against us. Maybe this is somewhat off the path here, but that thought kept arising to me as we were talking about this. Why?
form. You know, when you're given, when you first are hired, you're given a stack of forms to sign. And as I'm assuming county did it. I know I executed one, which will be ironic if you all have to decide whether or not to with one of these vague area swans. But the reality is I think it's sort of, you know, as you sign up for Cicera, as you sign up to your wage, you know, allocation, all of the rest, you're given that death benefit. So absent an HR person not doing their job, which could create a whole line of other issues about malfeasance on the part of an agency.
That is a good point, John. And we're not aware of other systems having this pre-election form available to members. But it is something that we can't get around and make it automatic because there's a statutory requirement to have a written election by the member for the optional settlement. I know other systems do struggle with situations where there is no election, no written election by the member, and they feel that the member would have wanted optional settlement too for their beneficiaries, and they struggle with that because they have to get around the statutory requirement of a written election by the member.
Agency that you're aware of has this form? Are we the only, because I know that was a question that they posed of you, you know, what are other CERL, you know, retirement systems doing? Does anyone else do this?
I don't know of any other system that does. And I think Gail reached out to some of the CEOs to ask.
I did talk with a number of other administrators, about 10 out of the other 19, and none of them have this type of form. And in conversations over the years, I haven't gotten the sense of anyone, any other system.
So if somebody becomes disabled, they then require them, even if they're in the hospital or something else, to fill out a form at that time rather than having this pre-election.
Correct. Yeah, they do have some do have staff that go to the hospital
and do those, but they don't have this pre-election. Okay. No, it's. Yeah. I was hoping that other agencies were dealing with the same issue of the, you know, what constitutes a reasonable period of time. Which anyway. Okay.
And I also did pose with some of their systems about, oh, have your board struggled with the period of time of the disability? Has anyone established any guidance around that or guidelines for the board themselves for consideration? And I don't think anything.
Which probably would make sense if they don't have the pre-election form.
Yeah.
Then clearly someone's disabled a sufficient period of time for them to then sign a form that says, I believe I'm disabled, I'm no longer able to work, and therefore, you know, I want to have this potential. Okay, interesting to know.
The only system that I know that's addressed this issue is LoSERA, Los Angeles County. And it's not that it's arisen before their board, but they publish and have for several years published sort of the Bible on disability in their Southern accounting systems. And it's a big thing, and they revise it every couple of years. And they actually deal with this issue and sanction what we're doing here in that manual. And I think I cited to that 10 years ago in the last memo. But not that it's actually arisen, but it's just that their legal interpretation of the law is the same and permits this interpretation as well. That's the only other reference in other systems that I work with. It just seemed to have come up.
Well, that would be cool. And so LoSERA actually then exists in the Bible, so to speak, if it still is. And so does it encourage members to fill out a form? Or I could see it being relevant with if someone is an active member, but they're going in for knee surgery or something. And they think, okay, well, what if something happens to me?
Right.
Practice, or I have something happen, maybe I should have a selection. Do they even have a form
agencies that send someone to the hospital or have a form, is it a form that says, in the event of my death, I'm not coming out of this, or is it I want to go ahead and apply for a disability from at this point on, just as our standard form is for an employee who's living who applies for a non-service-related disability?
It's my understanding they're actually disability applications.
Just a regular disability. It's not a if I die, yeah. I'm not sure I'm coming out of this. It's a just a regular. Okay.
Yeah. And I know that, and I also did talk with someone affiliated with Lucera, and we don't have a pre-election form like this either. Okay.
But I actually have a question. So, and for counsel either, could a member, like the day they got hired, go to their disability counselor, pull the papers, have them all signed, and just have their beneficiary fill in the reason and the date? Would that be legal?
Do you mean the act of death form?
No, no. I'm talking about if you don't have, since it sounds like we're the outlier, that we actually kind of give a form the same way like Judge Gordon, was it Gordon? Did, could a member in one of these other CERL systems just go see a retirement, a disability counselor, get the forms, have it all filled out except for cause of death, put it in their little safe in their home, and God forbid something happened, their family fills in cause of death, date of death, mails it in. Would that be legal?
Are you referring to a disability application?
A disability application.
Okay, so one thing I would like to clarify is that there is no legal requirement for the member to file a disability application.
Okay.
That can be filed by anyone.
Okay, thank you.
Employers, et cetera, anyone off the street can file a disability application. What is required under the law is a written election by the member to elect those optional settlements. Those are the ones that give the beneficiaries a higher benefit.
Okay, so drilling down a little further, if they did take the application, selected option two or four, and they pass, would that be a legally binding document? They signed it, elected two, and the family filled out everything else.
That sounds very much like the case we just talked about, Gorman versus Kranza.
That's what it sounds like to me. So just because we're the only system that, other trustees wanting to talk. So just because we're the only one that kind of pulls along, they would still have the option in those cases. Okay.
We can't speak on behalf of the other system, mm-hmm. but certainly the member and the beneficiaries would have a good argument that this is what the member intended and signed for, and they should get it.
Candace.
Okay, with your scenario, Todd.
Yeah.
The only question I have is with the death of the judge, he was clearly had some underlying health condition that was causing him to go into surgery. That's when he signed the form. It wasn't, I'm signing the form in case I someday get sick and I someday drop dead because of my illness. I sensed that the court recognized the judge knew he was sick. He knew he was likely going to be disabled. He knew there was a possibility that he would be because of his surgery. So I see that very different than on the day you're hired, filling out a form and putting it in the safe and say, if something happens to me, run to a doctor and have them attest that I was disabled.
No, no, and I see the difference as well. But when I didn't, from the materials, maybe you've read it more, and it sure seems like Scott's read it more, and I'm not an attorney, but I didn't get from your materials that the court took into consideration the fact, well, he knew there was a possibility. Am I reading that wrong?
And it's a really old
thing. Let me come at that way a different way, Todd, to get to this point. And I think we have to put death aside for a minute. Let's forget about death.
Good idea.
what the long half hour.
That's my comment. Thank you.
The other time, somebody else.
Just so you understand, in the Gorman case, what the law was under the judge's retirement system was that a judge could not file a disability application without the governor and the chief justice, not the governor, the chief justice and some other official signing off on the application. So there was going to be a period of delay for this application to be effective. So let's take the situation where, forget about that, a member goes into the hospital for whatever reason. They're not feeling well or whatever. And there is no certainty. They don't know that they're going to die, but they have a pretty good sense that, you know, I have a terminal condition, or I'm going to be laid up for many, 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 many months. I'm going to be disabled. At that point, if the member could physically come into Cesera's office, fill out a form electing to be to file a disability application, and file an optional settlement to choice. Is there any doubt in anyone's mind that we would accept that? If the member could physically come in, so there's no doubt about that scenario. We grant that. Now let's take the same scenario. The member physically can't come in to Cesera. They're in John Muir, but they have a family member. They're not dead, but they're clearly disabled. They're anticipating being disabled. They want to file. So they hand over a document to a family member and say, here's my disability application, and I've signed my election. I want to take option two. Family member drives over from Walnut Creek here, takes it into the office. Any doubt that we would grant that, or we would consider it, I mean, we'd have to decide if the person's disabled. So really what we're talking about, and the same thing in the Gorman case, is a situation where there's no time for anyone to make that election at the time they're disabled. They're disabled, and for a discernible period of time, we hope, they're disabled, but they're not yet clinically dead. Our form that we've been using allows that situation to be the equivalent of the other two that I raised with you, which is that but for just physical inability to timely deliver an application and an election before the person dies, this is a method that this board has approved for three decades of equalizing that member's choice to one that had the luxury of being able to physically bring in an application and an option of an election. It has nothing to do with death. It's just that here we've truncated the period in which they have the opportunity to apply and make the option selection. We've equalized that person with the person that has the luxury of time while they're in the hospital bed and can get a family member to drive over to 1200 Concord Avenue. That's really what this is about, I think, why the board has said in that situation, if we can, on medical evidence, discern that there was a disability before death in this case, it's not a death situation. It's a disability and then a death, and we're not letting that gap of even just minutes dictate the member's ability to choose an option. The irony is that during normal service, when a member chooses an optional settlement, they're taking a bet on the future. Because, look, classic situation, the member gets 100% of their benefit while the member's alive, and the survivor gets 60% of the continuing benefit. A And by option two, what they're saying is, I don't think I'm going to live very long in retirement. I want to provide for my spouse, so I'll give up my member benefit and I'll give 100% to my spouse. It still has to be the actuarial equivalent. We have Siegel come in and they calculate what's the stream of payment present value. It's got to be the same as if they had the normal retirement. 100 is 60. Goes to 0 and 100 for the survivor. But the actuarial benefit has to be the same. But what they're doing when they're taking the optional benefit in that situation is they're guessing their future. In this situation, we take the guesswork out of it because we have this springing election that says you're going to be dead the day after you, the day you retire on disability, you're going to be dead. You don't have to guess anymore. We're letting the form make you pre-elect that situation. And that may be why it's, you know, we've taken the gamble out of it for the member. But we do allow, and the law does allow, members to change their election all the way during service until they actually retire. So they can change their view of the gamble all the way up until their date of retirement. Anyway, so but I hope that helps to understand. I think what we're doing with this form is simply taking the prejudice, if you will, to the member who finds themselves in that nearly instantaneous short disability and nearly instantaneous death and equalizing them with a member that has the luxury of getting the application in on time. That's really what the form is.
Thank you. John? Harvey, just and this is maybe restating what we talked about a little bit earlier. We offer this pre-sign-up, this pre-application. No other system to our knowledge does this.
Correct.
So we've clearly made a decision going back to 2011 or perhaps earlier, to offer a process that will, certainly in some cases, lead to a benefit that we would pay that none of the other systems would pay.
That's not true.
I just want to confirm that. I understand.
No, it's my understanding.
Okay.
I haven't seen it come up anywhere else.
Rusty, then Jerry?
Just to clarify, if I understand correctly, again, the options, unmodified or modified, how early in your career can you as an employee make that decision? Is it only upon applying for retirement, or can it be made at the...
Every day.
Every day you make that decision. So could I, in effect, choose today option two until up to the point I decide to retire and then change it to unmodified so that just in the event that during my career I do get killed instantly, for that matter, the benefit's there for my beneficiary. No matter how I die, whether it's instantaneously or not, option two will be available to my spouse. Is that right?
So my response would be that legally, when you read the statutes about selecting optional settlements, there's no timing requirement there except that it can be changed before your first retirement allowance is paid.
Right.
But in practice, the decision of electing an optional settlement really should be done at retirement, and our process is that when someone applies for, let's say, a service retirement or disability retirement that gets granted, then they're given the option selection form, and then they're given exact amounts of what each one would give them, and they can make an informed decision on what would work for them. And so, for example, a member who might be terminally ill and retired might choose optional settlement two.
Right. And I understand that. I'm trying to see the value of having this form 104 in the first place.
Your scenario doesn't give them the disability retirement.
But then the disability can be applied by anybody, not employee necessarily. So my spouse could still apply for disability if I were to.
Correct. But here's the situation. Suppose you're a firefighter with 7 years of service. and you choose option two, and you die during service, if you can't apply for disability, then you're not going to get that. You know, the option two benefit that you get is going to be minuscule that you're leaving for your survival.
And explain why.
Without the disability, if you had the disability, you're going to be like a 50% benefit.
But again, if I were to die after 7 years of service, why couldn't my employer or the Social Security apply for that disability?
If you did.
They could.
They could, couldn't they? Service is slow death. Say if I burned in a fire.
Okay,
and I had seconds still alive. But obviously, I'm not going to survive this. But could my employer or CCCR then apply for that disability so my beneficiary gets that 50% off of my option two settlement?
If there's time before you die.
Yeah, no, I mean, if it's proven, I mean, by witnesses, whatever. So
and that's that instant, how long is that discernible
right.
period? And does it matter that whether you physically can get the application on file? That's what we're grappling
yeah.
with. Why does it matter that you can or can't show up at CSERA during business hours, during the period between disability and death? Should that matter? I think that's what that is.
Okay. Well, again, my main issue was, why do we have this form in the first place when there's other ways to go about it? For me, if I were to want to protect my beneficiaries, and they get the option to, I'd sign up today just in the event that I do die during service. And it's a slowdown. Okay, so it's a discernible time measure that I was for a period permanently incapacitated. So anyway, that's the reason why I bring this up. I'm just trying to put this together. Why we have the Form 104 when there's other ways to do it. But I can see the Form 104, but if I were to elect today unmodified, you're suggesting that with that form on file, though, that's going to trump what I had elected initially and change it to option two because that will, in fact, supersede it in time, right?
And I think that what you're talking about is really this form. You know, when you say, oh, if I elect option two, it's not just a service retirement option two. It's related to that disability that you want.
So is it a form that you use to kind of declare at the beginning of our, say, career what option we want upon retirement? And then, of course, at the point of retirement, we can change it to modify whatever else. Is that right?
But if you're talking about a service retirement and then you die, then you don't, you know, your spouse wouldn't receive that continuance.
Just a point of clarification.
You would get the, it's not a disability retirement at that point. So it would be.
But it could be a disability retirement.
Well, that's why we have the form, so that the form says that a disability
application
is filed.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, so I think that what you're talking about is similar to the form that we have. I think the intent of what you're saying is kind of what's included on the form.
Just a point of clarification. Council mentioned during service, and also was mentioned as an example of a firefighter having 7 years of service and dying in a fire. These would be service-connected disabilities, which is essentially different from what we're talking about, correct?
Yeah.
Right. I just want service was mentioned, and also during dying during fire.
But service is
not. It's not a great example to utilize, you know, a true service-connected.
Just firefighter dies out in the parking lot.
Correct. There you go. Thank you. I just wanted to point that out.
A non-service-connected disability.
Correct. During active membership.
More to somebody with 7 years of service than a service than a death benefit alone.
Yeah.
Not going to be 50%, but it's going to be worth more to that person than the death benefit alone. Yeah, and you're right. If there was a luxury of time while the person was disabled for them to have somebody file a disability application, it would date ultimately, if the board granted it, it would date from the date that it was filed, which preceded death by a measurable period of time.
Couldn't that form be the disability form or application even be filed after death? Isn't it like a time period of 4 months, or does it have to be done before death? Disability form?
No.
It doesn't have to be done before death, right?
No.
Yeah.
That's right.
So,
So just to, just to clear up, I have two questions. One is the Todd could file on my behalf a disability application if I'm in the hospital and in a coma, unable to write or unable to. He could actually file a disability application for me today.
Correct.
Correct. Okay. All right. Excellent. And then the other question I'm going to hold for later.
Okay, Jerry, waiting patiently.
It's the grimmest conversation I've been involved in. My wife frequently asks me what we talk about today, and I'll say we spent the first hour talking about death. And then we moved on. Short break. Several people left. Called their relatives. One of the more interesting things that I've heard is that no other system has such a form. I'm actually kind of shocked. I mean, we do a lot of that kind of conversation where we say things like, what do other people do? Have we checked? And there's some comments that I don't disbelieve the comments about where somebody said, well, they just don't seem to have come up with this. So how did the other... One of the questions is, this is a rhetorical question, how do the other 19 serial plans avoid death? Because we need to figure out how to do that. I mean, they must have had this circumstance come up. I can't believe when they don't have the circumstance come up. I see this form as a convenience, not to minimize it, but it's a convenient way of suggesting that we think circumstances may come up that could affect you, could impact you, and you'll want to think about that kind of stuff now. And you can, of course, change it at some later date. But we think you ought to start thinking about this now rather than having deathbed runs by CICERA employees over to CCU and John Muir to say, can you sign this? You know, or having the wife say, can you sign it? This seems more of a convenience. And it's kind of shocking to me that there isn't some similar accommodation in any of the other 19 serial plans. They must be okay with this, because I don't believe this doesn't come up. It has to come up. As I say, unless they figured out some way to avoid death. I'm not sure where I'm going with this, except to say, nice to know we have this accommodation. That's it. So.
Rusty?
Just again, my understanding, that Form 104, is it more to state the election of the settlement? Is it more for that purpose than anything else?
Yes.
Okay. All right. It's not to apply for a disability. It goes into effect of disability.
It does say that the member authorizes CICERA to file a disability application on behalf of the member in situations where the member has experienced a non-service-connected disability that leads to death.
And does the employee or member have to authorize CICERA to do that?
No.
All right. So
it's simply to elaborate the process and solidify it.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, so next we thought it would be important for the board's discussion to talk about what the death benefit is. Not active death, not a non-service-connected disability, but what does the CERL say the death benefit should be when there's a death? And so if the deceased member does not qualify for a disability retirement, death benefits are paid pursuant to CERL sections 31780 and on. There's a whole chapter in the book, the CERL book, that is titled Death Benefits. And so generally the death benefit to the beneficiary, or if there's no beneficiary, to the member's estate, is a lump sum payment. It's a lump sum payment, one-time payment, that's it. There's no ongoing allowance. That lump sum payment is the member's accumulated contributions, not the employer contributions, the member's contributions, plus the salary death benefit, which is an amount that is calculated as 1 month of member's compensation earnable for each full year of service credit, not to exceed 6 months of compensation. Those two together are a lump sum payment that is paid to the beneficiary, or if there's no beneficiary, to the member's estate. There is another optional death benefit to the extent
members' contributions, is that plus interest?
Yes.
And is that the interest as the assumed rate, or is it a different interest rate?
It is the assumed rate of return.
Okay. Thank you.
It's credited to the
members. It
goes to their account every 6 months. So let's talk about the optional death benefit. This is not a lump sum. This is in lieu of the lump sum. To the extent that the member leaves behind the surviving spouse, or if there's no surviving spouse, the minor children, they get to make an election. They get to see this lump sum payment amount and compare that with a with an optional death benefit and decide what's best for them. That optional death allowance equals 60% of the disability retirement allowance the deceased member would have received had he or she been retired on a non-service-connected disability at the time of death. So it's 60%. So then the surviving spouse or child looks at that amount, 60%. What is that amount paid to me monthly for my lifetime versus the lump sum payment? I think for the most part, they would probably choose the allowance over the lump sum. Am I correct?
Yes.
And this is what the SURL says has to be paid if someone dies. This optional death allowance is found in Government Code Section 31781.1. Okay, next I'll turn it over to Tim Hoppe.
Okay, for members that have the form on file, meet the eligibility requirements of 5 years and 10 years, and goes before, provides the medical evidence, it comes before the board, and the board grants the non-service-connected disability. The difference it makes to the beneficiary, the unmodified 60% allowance, and this is looking at the last six transactions or non-service-connected disability deaths that the board approved, the average 60% benefit was $1,565. Under the Option 2 benefit, that amount increased to $2,065. And again, it's an actuarial equivalent to the unmodified allowance, so there no windfall occurs. Looking at our range, I mean, we see a lot of different ranges from the six individuals that the board granted. The one that comes closest to the example was an unmodified amount of $2,800 with a 60% continuance of $1,700. And for the beneficiary, it changed it to a $2,200 monthly benefit. In this case, both the member and the beneficiary were the same age. And so when they went through the calculation, you can see, you know, one benefit went down quite a bit, $1,100. But if you compare it to the option two from the unmodified, it was a $600 reduction.
Tim, before you move on, it might be interesting to find out from you what circumstances might happen when the numbers are flipped and it actually is more beneficial to have the death benefit as opposed to the non-service-connected disability benefit.
In the examples we've looked at, we haven't come across where they flipped. You know, it's always been advantageous for the individuals to have the death benefit on form. In some cases, the service retirement benefit was greater, but the option two provided greater than the 60%. Where we encounter the benefit, having the form on file, for example, would be the beneficiary is of a much more advanced age, and their life expectancy is shorter, or they want to receive the funds to pay it to maybe grandchildren or other children, and the collection period, you know, they have an illness, the collection period may be 6 months that they think they're going to collect the benefit. And the contributions and the salary benefits is in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So Tim just described an incident where having the form on file would be a disadvantage to the member.
Yes.
Just so
Charity, you had something?
I'm sorry, can I go back one earlier page, just back to 21, just for a second? When I read this, this note raised several questions for me. I guess I'm looking for clarification. It speaks of no unmarried children, child or children. So that kind of suggests minor children, dependent children, but the word dependent is not in there. And then it says, may make an election of the optional death allowance through a legally appointed guardian, which again suggests that they are dependent children.
They're minors.
Okay, so.
I didn't include here the exact verbiage from the statute, but they're minors.
Okay, that might have helped. But typically, you wouldn't have married children that have a guardian. It's not spoken of, but it's kind of confusing as you wander through that. Maybe the full verbiage is more.
It's unmarried minor child.
Right.
Okay.
Because they could still be, for example, in school and eligible for a benefit at college up until age 22. But if they were married at 19, the benefit would cease.
And let's say, not to further confuse us, but say there's two children for some clarity, and one of them makes the application. In theory, they're making the application on behalf of the other child as well, not just themselves. But I suppose that could be tricky as well, too, when one child says, well, actually, that other child shouldn't get any. But the guardian says that other child shouldn't get any. Either you could conceive of some battles involved in some of these things, I suppose.
Yeah, and in those situations, the CERL talks about some benefits that minors may be entitled to, and they always require a legal guardian to act on their behalf to make that decision. It's not just this one. There's other ones in the CERL. And what happens procedurally is we require a letter of guardianship, and if there are questions like that, there's another possible child, or, you know, we ask the court to tell us what they would like us to do. So we don't get into deciding, you know, which child should make the election. The court will tell us what to do through the guardian.
And then that could be a court-appointed guardian, I suppose. Right. Because, sadly, a lot of these cases end up being intestate. There's nothing out there to give you guidance as to how this should be taken care of. So it's a court-appointed guardian, which could become even more complicated.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Back to that same screen again, sorry. For clarification, does the optional death allowance cease upon the person, the child, the only child, say, getting married? Or does that child still receive the benefit until death?
Once they attain the age of majority, it stops.
Okay, it does stop. And secondly, what about adults with special needs? Are they considered minors if they can't take care of themselves?
No.
They're not. So this is only for minors as far as, because some adults with special needs do have guardians here. They will have to be taken care of for the rest of their lives, but this would not qualify.
To have this benefit.
All right. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Okay. As far as how many of these have come before the board over the last 5 years. So far, over the last 5 years, 7 different cases have come before the board. One has already been presented this year. The cases have been pretty much split between cancer-related or heart-related. So the volume is relatively low. We do have a lot of individuals that have the form on file, but due to the eligibility requirements of 10 years on a tier, say tier 3, they do not meet the eligibility requirements if they were to pass away before having 10 years of service.
This reminds me sometimes of this form. If this form is signed early in a person's tenure or career, I don't think half the people in the room, maybe much higher percentage than that, would remember most of the forms they signed the day they started their job. Is this the sort of thing, remind me whether or not we let people know periodically what their designation is, like every 5 years or 10 years, because somebody might say, my husband signed this 20 years ago when he first got hired, but I had no idea. So is there a way that, is it evergreen in terms of letting people know what the benefit was they selected, or is once they selected, I know they can change it, but once they selected, if they don't remember to ask, or if they're not reminded of what the benefit is, it's not changed.
To my knowledge, we don't. There is a follow-up communication. However, individuals that attend the pre-retirement workshops, we do notify them of their status and whether the form is on file.
At which time they probably say, Tim, I forgot that. Tim, isn't it on our annual benefit statement?
It is not on the annual benefit statement, but it is at least annually in our newsletters, reminding people that it is a benefit, and we get a lot of phone calls at that time where they confirm if they have it.
Well, that's my question, too. Could it be included as an indicator or something on the annual benefit statement that there is a form on file?
Can
Dr.
Lord?
It's kind of where I was going with the sort of thing, just to remind you that you have this.
So we're asking on the member statement that it actually says on there whether or not they have the, we have the form on file.
Something to that effect. Something just to indicate, remind them it is on file. Or not. Yeah. Not necessarily what they chose, but just to indicate whether you have it on file.
Something we can take a look at. So here on slide 24, we get to the question of instant death or disability leading to death. And there has to be medical evidence regarding whether the death occurred instantaneously or whether the death occurred after some period of incapacity. From talking to Dr. Blink, we do now have a definition of death that is that has been adopted in California. And it is found in Health and Safety Code, Section 7180. It has been adopted from the Uniform Determination of Death Act. It appears on slide 25 in your packet. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Dr. Blink, who is, as you know, the board's medical advisor, and he has looked at these cases for us. And we talked to Dr. Blink about what medical evidence you look at when you arrive at your conclusions, your recommendations to the board regarding the disability prior to death, and maybe talk a little bit about not only the medical evidence that you see as to individual cases, but also generally medical literature and your experience about incapacity that leads to death.
All right, well, cheerful subject today.
There's actually a person behind the signature. Those of us that have been around for a while know you only as a signature, so it's nice to see you in person.
Likewise, thank you. So as long as we have this slide up here, perhaps that's a good place to begin, is to define what death is, which is surprisingly not a trivial matter. And the way this mostly comes up in medicine is in organ donation. So you can't take an organ from a registered organ donor until that person is dead, whatever that means. And that's where this Uniform Determination of Death Act actually came from. And it's been adopted by 30-some states. And it's both clear and unclear. So irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory functions. And this is California has adopted this, so this is what we're operating under. But the word or there kind of gives you some pause. And the second or is irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brain stem, is dead. Well, this is somewhat resolved by the third clause there, which is a determination of death must be made in accordance with accepted medical standards. So what are accepted medical standards? Well, it turns out that it's basically the neurologists have primarily taken that, and they are the determining factor. And there's some other issues there as well. But the seminars in neurology from 2015 explained the brain death guidelines, and there's a statement in the abstract that says the actual neurologic evaluation in a patient suspected of being brain dead
requires 25 tests and verifications. So you're talking about perhaps, I didn't mark them all up, but certainly EEGs, probably repeated EEGs, probably neurologic testing to determine that there are no, say, reflexes that would be, require central nervous system function, et cetera, 25 different tests. So in order for somebody to be determined to be brain dead, there's a great deal that must happen for that to occur. But is there a difference between death, if you consider brain death to be death, which by use of this set of medical standards would appear to me to be the case? Is there a difference between death and disability? Okay, so next question is, what is disability? Well, disability, what is a disabled person? Well, first of all, it has to be a living person. Okay, so if you're alive and you cannot, and you're incapacitated, whatever the definition of that may be, then we can say that that is an incapacitated person. So someone in a coma could be incapacitated. Depending on the definition, someone with a lower extremity injury might be incapacitated. Depends on what category we're talking about here. But there is a difference between death and incapacity. So, for instance, the American Heart Association has a quick fact sheet called CPR Facts and Statistics. This was basically being issued primarily to promote the use of AEDs, automated external defibrillators. And they have a list of bullets here. And the fifth bullet says, death from sudden cardiac arrest is not inevitable. So what's sudden cardiac arrest? Basically, for whatever reason, the heart stops pumping. There's no more circulation. The oxygen is not reaching the brain. Within a matter of seconds, the brain stops, consciousness ceases. And if this continues, you get a continued cascade of loss of brain function. So death from cardiac arrest is not inevitable. Right there, there's a difference between death and cardiac arrest. Okay, so this is, again, accepted medical standards. So death does not mean your heart stops. So when your heart stops, you're not dead. And there's plenty of people who have had their heart stops who have been resuscitated and who are walking among us today. Obviously, your heart stopping, it does not mean you're dead. Okay, so what does mean you're dead? Well, you're left with this neurologic determination of brain death of the entire brain. Okay. So, next question they ask is, if disability means a living person,
just a question on that again. So my concern has been that the disability is not made permanent in the recent cases until death. I know that it's probably wrong. But I guess what I'm concerned about is whether the disability is exactly that. Is it permanent? How do you determine when the disability itself is permanent before death?
Well, it's just that we get the paperwork after death, and so if they're dead, it was permanent.
But, see, again, going back to your argument that earlier, Harvey, that death is not the disability. And it seems to be putting a stamp on it and saying, now it is. But this is a permanent disability, and so therefore we should award the disabilities.
So then the question is, what is permanence? So if a disability, if this is not a medical fact, this is going to be a legal and philosophical issue, I guess. But basically, I think from just common sense, if someone is disabled and they remain disabled until death, whether that's 10 years from now, a week from now, or a second from now, they were in fact permanently disabled. Now, the third thing I was going to get to was duration. So I think that's really the crux of what we're talking about here. Death, I think we can agree, appears to be by the definitions under the Uniform Determination of Death Act, neurologic death. Cardiac cessation does not equal death. So really what we're talking about here is sudden death. Somebody used the term earlier, instantaneous. I'm not sure what that means. And we can drill down into that a little further as we try to look at where science leaves off and philosophy begins. And so disability means a living person who can't function in the way that
whatever the definition requires. Death means neurologic death. So let's just look at cardiac death. For whatever reason, if the heart stops pumping, there is a period of time, and it's somewhere between 4 and 5 minutes, maybe as long as 6, after the heart stops beating, before there is any brain damage. So if your heart stops beating and you get successful resuscitation started within 4 or 5 minutes, oxygen goes to the brain again, chances are excellent that you will walk away with a fully intact brain. If it goes on for 6 minutes, you're going to be losing parts of your brain. If it goes on for 10 or 20 minutes, you're going to lose virtually all of the brain. None of it's going to come back. It's true neurologic death. The exceptions are cold water drownings. So somebody is immersed in ice cold water, falls through a crack in the ice, and you can get considerably prolonged periods where the brain can be preserved. But those are weird situations, and it's still just a matter of actually extending the time. But there's always going to be at least 4 minutes between the cessation of circulation and even the beginnings of brain damage. Okay, so we know that there's always going to be 4 minutes where there's going to be, and most people use 5, but I thought one reference used 4, so let's just say 4. But for a matter of minutes, no circulation does not equal death. Okay, so now the question is, does our definition of disability require a duration? Well, I've looked over the materials that council and the staff have supplied me that I've been using for years as to what the definition of a disability is, and it says nothing about duration. It just says that you're incapable of performing for Tier 1 in safety, you're incapable of performing the functions required of your usual duties, or for Tier 3, any job recently available to you given your training, and all those typical words that are used in that definition. It's immaterial in this setting. Basically, regardless of what chair you are, if you're unconscious because your heart's not beating and yet your brain is not yet dead, it doesn't matter what chair you are. So the question is duration. So let's talk about duration. Since we don't have any clear definition within any of the materials that I've seen for Sisera, is there some other definition that we can use from the medical literature? Well, the answer is no. I mean, disability is something which is determined by legal systems and perhaps by philosophical systems, but there's no medical definition of what duration is required, at least not that I was able to find. So if someone cannot work for a whole work day in many systems, that's a date of disability. Okay, so I think we can all accept that a whole day off work means you're disabled. How about for an hour? How about for a minute? How about for a second? And now we start entering the realm of metaphysics. So somewhere around a tenth of a second, depending on how you measure, is the response time from stimulus to someone being able to react to it. And so is a tenth of a second or a sixteenth of a second, is that a reasonable period? Somebody used the word discernible period. Discernible to what? We can measure very small durations scientifically using various instrumentation. So I don't know what the answer to that is. It is a policy question. It's not a medical question. And to a certain extent, it would be a legal question if it were challenged. And I don't know how the court might rule on that.
Question, Harvey.
Rusty raises really critical question, and you respond to that. We do require the condition of disability to be permanent and stationary, so that if someone breaks their knee and they're out for knee surgery and they can be repaired, and they're not permanent, the disability is not permanent and stationary, and we don't grant them disability benefit. Rusty raises the point that, well, what if, how do we know they're disabled if they can be resuscitated during that period where they had hearts
condition at that time could resuscitate that individual. If that's the case, then that condition is not permanent and stationary. Has a disability, and you wouldn't be able to grant that disability. So duration, I think, begs that question about, is there a condition during that duration permanent and stationary, or could they be, in other words, if you could come in after heart stoppage, if you could get medical treatment at that point and be resuscitated and put back on your feet and go back to work the following Monday, you're not disabled under our legal definition that we have to call.
Well, in the situation you posit, obviously it's not permanent. And I won't be able to get that piece of paper. So the only cases that I'm going to get are people who have, in fact, died regarding this dysfunction. So this is in a situation where someone is disabled prior to death. So if they didn't die, I mean, it's a different question. And in terms of, you also mentioned the term permanent and stationary. I don't think we actually have the word stationary in the language that we use. It's permanent incapacitation. But stationary means it's not changing. In fact, that's not part of the definition that I've been given to
use. There's different systems that use a piece of that story. Yeah. Some systems use MMI, maximum medical life. In other words, you have to reach the point where reasonable medical intervention cannot cure your incapacity. However, it's defined. That's why I say you're stationary.
Yeah, that's the usual terminology of workers' comp, which is the world that I inhabit much of the time. But in this, it's a serious specific world. It actually is not part of it, but I think the main point here is that anybody who has, to whom I'm, for any file that I'm given under this form 104, they've already died. So that means that if they were disabled prior to death, indeed they were disabled until they died. And to me, someone who was disabled until death had a permanent disability. That's disabled. So going back to the duration of death, we've got several scenarios. Someone who was ill for a period of days or weeks or perhaps hours, we call that a relatively slow death when we're discussing these issues. How about someone who is shot in the head? So somebody mentioned this before. We can get metaphysical here. You know, was there a nanosecond from the destruction of brain material where the bullet entered to the point where it actually destroyed the brain stem? Yes, there was. Is that a discernible period of time of disability? Is that really disability at all? Frankly, I think that's getting a bit precious. But it's not a medical, that's just my personal opinion, it's not a medical fact. It's a matter for policy to decide. What if somebody steps on a landmine? Is there a period, nanoseconds again, from the time that the legs are no longer usable to the time that the brain is no longer usable? Again, not a medical issue, but something else to consider. So, determining what the duration of time of disability, that is really the crux of this. So, someplace between an injury that prevents function and cessation of brain function is a finite amount of time. Even if you're standing next to a nuclear weapon, when it goes off, there's still going to be some picosecond at the speed of light, which is, by physics, a measurable time period. But I think that probably would not be discernible to most people. So when you come down to it, that's really the issue. And I've got a few more references, which I've sent to the staff at the field of medical literature. But duration is not something that's in medicine.
No,
so,
and you're not going to ask one question that you have regarding are there other
other medical conditions that might do the lower surgery for the
MDF? You know, a massive stroke, you know, something like that. Are there natural health conditions besides the stepping on the landmine, the shooting in the head? I'm just still trying to wrap my arms around, no matter what, is this going to apply to anybody who is deceased per our current definition? So I'm just curious, in your opinion, wouldn't it, you know, absent other intervening circumstances, wouldn't this apply to just about any single death? That someone would be deemed disabled prior to their death?
Short of the extremely rapid loss of brain function that you would see with standing next to a nuclear weapon or getting a gunshot wound to the brain, I think any natural cause, there's going to be a discernible period between cessation of full bodily function and cessation of brain function. There's no virus that's going to make all your brain cells shut down instantaneously without some period of dysfunction beforehand. A clot of both carotid arteries, or if you only have one carotid artery, it's going to have the same anoxic effect on the brain as the cessation of heartbeat. So there isn't any other than these extreme examples of violent force,
right.
There's no natural death that would avoid some period of brain bodily impairment and brain impairment prior to cessation of brain function.
Jerry, then we'll.
It's getting bleaker all the time. I was reminded of the story of the guy who, or the crew who dies in an airplane as they crash into the mountain. It's not the crash that kills them, it's the sudden stop, which is the problem. It's kind of like a skydiver. They're okay until that very last second before they hit the ground, and then they're not. You didn't write Health and Safety Code 7180, so I don't want to give you credit for the authorship. I can't help myself about editing. I find the word "is dead" very confusing at the end. It says an individual who sustained either irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory function or irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brain, is dead. You didn't write that. I assume that is a faithful reproduction of the Health and Safety Code, but it's pretty awkwardly written. I mean, you might. I'm not going to edit that because it's not my job and they wouldn't care. But I found that just a little cumbersome. So, but another definition we could go by, a person who sustains or achieves and sustains room temperature for a protracted period of time. Could add that as a possible definition of death. If your room temperature long enough, then that's a problem. Right, David?
Except in the room and hanging.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would just like to ask, in the big picture of all of this, what does this really mean to Sisera? We know what it means to the individual. Right? They have this form on file, and they die while they're in active service for the county. But if it's an actuarial equivalent, if there's really not a difference in expense, and we're talking about one person per year, big picture wise, what is the impact of all of this? We can continue to split hairs, and spend another 5 hours on this, but I think that what we provide our members, even though we're the only one who does this, I think we're very progressive
I'm proud that we do offer this for our members, and I just like to know what all this means, because I think it's we have a place that's good, and I think we should continue the practice that we've been doing for years. And
it's a good question. Well, then, Rusty.
No, it brings up a great question, Dr. McGall, in terms of what we're doing. I mean, this has been going on for 3 decades. It's legal. It's not illegal. It seems like we're getting into splitting hairs or splitting nanoseconds or picoseconds and determination philosophically of what death is. I think it's a great service that we offer our members, and I think we should continue to do it. I agree with you, Doctor. So, great point.
Rusty?
I guess to answer your question, to point out, kind of since brought this up, so Scott, this is a, I don't know if it's philosophical or moral or what, question that we're struggling with here, and we have to address it because it's on the board to make the decision whether to grant it. So that's why we're here today discussing it, trying to figure out together if we create some consensus, I should say, on what does it mean, in this case, for these two, me and myself, to be dead, okay, or to be permanently disabled. I struggle with that, too, the duration part, and even the cause leading up to death. And yes, we've been practicing for 3 decades, but it's only a few handful of few cases where we've had this debate whether or not they were actually disabled before they died, because they died when nobody was around to see just how quickly they died. So I support the program. I think it's great, but I struggle with, again, what is non-disconnected service disability in this case. If somebody dies, we're not there to witness it.
But what does it mean? I mean, the assumption is, just real quick, on someone who's found dead,
right,
and per coroner or per medical history, that it more than likely they suffered a heart attack.
Yeah.
Well, the assumption is that's been minutes that person is, taken to finally succumb. So I think in those situations, we've had discussions about those individuals who were found dead, and we don't have someone with a stopwatch there,
right,
clocking how long it takes them to go. But it's reasonable to assume that it's going to take minutes for that to happen, so I think that's kind of an automatic. But still, even for somebody who's shot in the head, what does it mean to Sisera to deny them a disability status if they've been alive for a nanosecond before? What does it mean? I mean, is it like a long-term financial gift to Sisera in the membership? Or?
And I don't think that we're opposed to that for that reason. We're not trying to prevent anybody from getting their pension or the benefits from Sisera. I don't think that's the issue. The issue is, and our role as fiduciaries, we're asked to make a decision whether somebody's permanently disabled or not. And we're struggling with that definition. Is it nanoseconds before they die? Can you count that?
But what is a fiduciary consequence? What does it all mean to the system? I mean, we're here to look after and the association and the membership as a whole. But if there really is no fiduciary consequence, to saying, okay, well, this person was shot in the head and they survived for 5 nanoseconds.
So then my biggest support. Then why even have this discussion?
Well, that was John's good. Why not make it, automatic?
Yeah, or, and again, I wondered even if we had to go through this process, but it's been done for three decades, that we
have a file on, a form on file, a 104 form on file. And, you know, possibly there are other ways to do this without bringing it to the board to struggle with. But anyway.
I guess it comes to the board as an issue of formality from what I get. But I guess that's it. I mean, because so if I've worked for the county for 50 years and I, you know, let's say I retire when I'm 80, then I'm going to want to rethink this whole thing and say maybe my wife should just give me cash because, you know, versus if I'm 60 and there looks like there's another 20 years of survival for my spouse or something like that. So it's, yeah, like Harvey said, it's kind of a gamble. It's like, what do you think is going to happen with your life and so forth? And how is this going to benefit your spouse?
And to be honest, when I make the decision, I'm not considering how this is going to benefit us. To see Sarah, how can we keep some money back in the pot and not have to give it out? I don't think that crosses my mind or anybody else's in this case. I mean, you obviously want to make sure the beneficiaries are taken care of. You know, I think we all have a heart to care enough about them that they get the maximum benefit. But again, I guess the struggle is where this disability permit and, you know, is a nanosecond enough to say fully disabled and not get the benefit? If it is, you know, then they should get the benefit. I just don't know if we all agree that that's the definition.
Well, see, again, is there a fiduciary consequence to going one way or the other?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, the fiduciary consequence is not whether or not there's a de minimis financial impact on this. That's really not the fiduciary question. The board is fiduciary to the trust fund, have a fundamental obligation to pay the correct level of benefits as authorized by the law. As trustees, we follow the plan document, if you will. Our plan document includes not our policies, but it includes our law. We have an obligation to prudently interpret the provisions of the law to carry out their intent and to exercise the best collective judgment in doing that. And with the idea that we will pay out considered to be able to log into it and be a proper benefit to those who are entitled to it directly. So what we're struggling with is interpreting our plan document, our trust instructions, if you will. Those of you who have family trusts and that sort of thing know that you put some bank or you put a family member in as trustee and you wrote a trust document and you gave instructions on how to administer the trust. We have the same thing. We have a trust document. The law, its policies, it's the Internal Revenue Code. But we have to interpret all those things to try to decide what's been entrusted to us and what we're supposed to do to carry that out. In the private sector, oftentimes what happens is if you have a family trustee who has unclear instructions or can't interpret what the instructions are, you'll petition the court for instructions. You go into court and say, I've been given, you know, there's a trust or my family or somebody has written a trust document. I can't figure it out or it can go either way. You know, what am I supposed to do? And a court, you know, and there is always that option, even for boards in the public sector, to go into court and say, well, declaratory relief, if you will, or petition for instructions and say, we're torn over an important administrative decision. What should we do? And the court will weigh in. As I've told you in my most recent memorandum, from my perspective as fiduciary counsel, you can interpret the law either way. The way that we've been doing it the last three decades at CICERA, and we fixed that about 8 or 9 years ago. We tweaked that a little bit. We made some revisions to clean up that, make sure the board actually makes a disability determination if that wasn't going on before. But you can also literally read, I think it's read section 31781 of the code, which says if a member dies, here's what you get. And you could say, well, the legislature has to intend that this alone is the death benefit. And nail it in from there. The point is that if I grappling with it, by analyzing it, by having medical evidence in front of you, by looking at the case, by reading the law, by looking at the Supreme Court, the only case that's come down in California is one Supreme Court decision on anything like this. And you weigh all that, and somebody said this way you get paid the big bucks. This way you get paid the big bucks for sitting on this board. As trustees, you have to come to a collective decision as to how you're going to implement the law. I would defend, if this were ever attacked in court, even whichever way you go on, I could absolutely defend the exercise of your collective judgment as a prudent, appropriate fiduciary determination by the court. Because you could go either way on that. And I think a court could go either way. What I don't put a thumb on the scale of this, but I think if you look at the public policy discussion by the Supreme Court as to the intent of leaving the maximum benefit possible to survivors in an unfortunate situation like this, that tends to weigh, I think, in favor as a public body of doing the best you can to assist the member under these horrible circumstances. But that's a judgment call, too. And I'm not trying to, throw the room and step back. I'm just trying to tell you that not all judgment calls are crystal clear. This one's not crystal clear. But you have substantial reasons to go whichever way you go on it. You just have to make a collective decision and live with it. That's where we are. But that's the fiduciary. The fact that it is from a financial standpoint, because you only have one or two members every couple of years affected by it, the consequence financially is de minimis. It's not going to move the needle. It's not going to change contribution rates. It's not going to make the system underfunded or overfunded. It's just not going to move the needle. But that's not the sole fiduciary consideration. Does that make sense?
So, finally, I mean, one of the reasons why we're having this discussion is because the last time we faced this situation, then it was ruled in favor of because we had done it before. And we were concerned about setting a precedence here. So we figured, okay, let's regroup and let's discuss whether or not we want to allow this to go forward so that it's never going to be a debate again. We'll just decide, okay, we've done it twice now. From here on, it's going to be always a rubber stamp. And I don't know if we're there yet. We all agree that that's going to be the policy from this point forward. Or should we change it from this point forward and say, no, there's going to be even more measurable time to decide whether or not they were actually permanently disabled. There's a concern here, whether it has to be witnessed or it has to be more evidence, medical evidence that supports the idea that, yeah, this person could reasonably have remained alive for a period of time, measurable period of time, before dying.
For me, and to approach the question, why are we discussing it? I think it definitely goes to our fiduciary duty. I mean, Harvey clearly stated our fiduciary duty isn't just dollars. It really is correctly applying the law, correctly looking at facts and circumstances. And what troubled me from day one was really what constitutes a disability. And we spend a lot of time reviewing living members' disability applications. And just these very plaintive, sob stories that come before us of people who are not adequately able to establish that they do, in fact, have a permanent disability that entitles them to this retirement. And so I do find it troubling when we say someone is disabled for the 2 minutes before they passed away, because is that truly a disability? And so that's really where, for me, it was challenging. I was surprised, and this is why when we had these first cases that we discussed, I asked for the numbers of how often this was happening and whether or not we were calculating this into our actuarial assumptions. I assumed that because we do apply it so broadly, that we would have more situations. And I don't know why we don't have more situations, if it's just because most people have been members long enough that it doesn't make sense for their families to end up with it, whatever reason. But that was a challenge for me. And so this is really... It still continues to be a struggle. I, particularly the fact that no other, you know, Cyril, retirement board really goes through this same process as sort of this, yeah, you know, do it ahead of time. I get why it makes sense to allow someone to do it so you don't have to run to the hospital, but I am still concerned that we are in essence saying, if you've died, that whatever period of time leading up to your death, even if it's not, you know, no one witnessed it, it's not discernible, there must have been that period of time in which you were disabled. And to me, that doesn't meet the same standard we require of other individuals who come before us who are disabled, other than, yes, they must have been disabled because they ended up dying. And that's the trouble I have. I feel like if we're going to continue this, we need to almost characterize it different as you will be entitled to this because we can't think of any circumstances you won't. It'll be, to John's point, a death benefit that then we would want to ensure we're calculating appropriately from an actuarial standpoint.
I had a couple of quick comments. One is that, you know, I think that the board is asking some good questions around this benefit, around, you know, can we offer this, should we offer this? And then from that, it becomes, okay, what's the process behind offering, you know, this benefit? And that's where the form comes into play, right? Because, you know, Sathira has a lot of different forms, but how many times have the board had a lively discussion around a certain form? It doesn't happen. And I think that, you know, Sathira has a good governance structure in place so that the board isn't continually talking about form changes and that type of thing. But when it comes to this form, I think that it is appropriate and important for the board to be discussing this because although currently it has a de minimis impact on the plan, it is important to, you know, as you're grappling with these other considerations, the financial consideration and the way that this flows through our system is through the valuation report and through the establishment of contribution rates for our employers and our employees. And that, you know, when we're looking at the numbers, what happens with this benefit is it, you know, as Siegel is looking at the disability incident rate and the impact it has on the system, you know, we have assumptions around those things. And that if there is an additional awareness by members of this form and it's filed, so we have more of the file than filed, or we have a higher incidence of active deaths, that could have an impact on that assumption where we need to change it. It could have actual gain or loss from that assumption. So, you know, it is de minimis, but I did want to, and that's not a pro or con argument. I'm just saying, you know, this is information also for the board, just to keep in mind how that does flow through our system, this discussion, and how that could potentially change in the future. Because I think that is a consideration. But I do think that, and I did at the beginning, I did want to welcome Dr. Blank. I think that is valuable to have him here. You see a lot of papers with his name on it. And I did want to also acknowledge Harvey's comment about the, you know, the permanent and stationary. Because a lot of times we talk about, oh, they're disabled from the heart. They have a disability because of a heart attack. No, they don't have a disability because of a heart attack they had, or whatever condition, they have a disability because it wasn't something that could be fixed. You know, it is permanent. It's not the heart attack. It's what happened after that heart attack that leads to this benefit. And so I think that that's, that was an important distinction to make, I think, as well. So I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you. Well,
yeah, just a couple of things you mentioned. That people are struggling with whether or not the person is permanently disabled. The doctor has very clearly evident kind of common sense. If you have a disability and then you die, that is permanent. So it is permanent. Right? It's a permanent disability. That any case that the doctor is seeing is permanent. And then I keep hearing about the question of time, and to the doctor's point, nothing in any documentation or law is any, there's no definition of time defined, and we can have philosophical questions and answers and discussion about this probably for a week of what actually defines, you know, metaphysically or looking at picoseconds. I mean, we could just keep talking about this. But what is clear is that the person is disabled and that the person, it is permanent. And this is, again, this has been going on for 3 decades. This, just to point some other things out, just to clear things up, on the forum, and this is on the website, this is mentioned at the to all the members when they come on for new employees. It's also mentioned at the education sessions that they have at the employer's offices. This forum is brought up. The title of the forum is Death During Active Membership. In the forum, it says Leading to Death. Again, there's no actuarial difference, I've heard, between the two options because they're actuarially equivalent. There's no cost to the system. If there is any cost, it's going to be accounted for at the normal cost to the employee and the employers. Again, it's so infrequent. It's 5 years. We've had 7 cases. What somebody said is that they're struggling with this. I'm not struggling with this at all. It's very clear to me. What I'm struggling with is that why is this board looking at this in this type of, like, gnat hair example of this thing? This is a great service. I have to agree with Dr. McDonald. It's a great service that we offer. We're actually proactively thinking about, instead of running down to the hospital and having this form filled out, I'm struggling with that we're spending so much time on this, on an over $8 billion pension system, and it's like a tiny, tiny little thing, and it's a benefit to our members. And if it's on the fence for anybody, go to the policy on, forget the name of the policy, starts with a P. Sorry. No, just in terms of the ethics policy, I believe that we have. If it's ever a tie, it should go to the member. I think in this situation, it's very clear. It should go to the member. This is we're getting into talking about. The doctor has very clearly defined any questions that I've had in terms of definition of death, timing. I've had gunshot patients with bullets to the head that are still breathing, that are still trying to talk, that recover. I've had colleagues that have had people attempt to take their own lives or take their own lives with full rifle shots to the head where half their head is gone. They're still breathing and still moaning. So, I mean, you could argue that they're still technically alive. They're definitively, permanently disabled. But they are still alive. And it's just to hear the things that we can actually, Todd could file something for me in the hospital, anybody could file something for my employer for a disability application, that takes away that question. It's just everything's been answered. It's very clear to me that this is allowed. This is allowed legally. This is allowed actuarially. This is allowed medically. Everything is very clear to me. So I'm not struggling with this at all. Again, I'm struggling with why we're spending so much time on this. There's a policy. Can somebody remind me of the policy? It's from my. There's a handbook. Fiduciary ethics. Is that what it is? So in there, it says there's actually a line. What I was trying to provide is not that you're being unethical. That is, if there is a question in your mind and you're on the fence, in that policy, fiduciary ethics handbook, for us, actually says if there's ever a decisive moment where it's essentially, should it be to the employer or the employee? It should go to the member. Is essentially what it says.
That's what I was trying to make. Situation. I mean, that's sort of like if you're in a tight situation. What we're trying to grapple with today, at least for me and some of my health board members, is what constitutes a disability. It's not the necessarily the nanosecond. It's really taking a deep dive into how this has been applied and whether we're moving it on. So anyway, I just, anytime you start sort of questioning someone's ethics on any board, it's a little bit of a red flag that can be offensive to your fellow board members.
You know.
Well, I apologize for you taking that message. I was trying to provide essentially the, if you are on the fence, to provide essentially, lean towards the member in hearing this decision. In addition to everything of medical definition that we've heard from in terms of disability, permanent, we've heard all these things, all these examples. I was just providing further guidance for you to assist in making a decision. If you still are on the fence with everything that we've heard today, then just go to that, essentially just follow that policy and go to the member. That's what I was trying to say. So I apologize if you took offense to misconstruing that you're unethical. That's not what I was saying.
David, then Rusty, then Jerry.
So, Candace, I appreciate your question about, you know, what is the essence of the meaning of disability, and if we're going to apply that in one situation, and should we also apply it in this other situation? And what we usually deal with is a term of disability for a person who's going to receive a benefit for however much period of time, but for that individual. But in this case, with death, it's basically the member's pension or membership in our retirement association has value. And in essence, with this form, it's a declaration of how they want that value to be applied or sorted out. So the individual member is not going to benefit from this, but they're looking after their beneficiaries, how the value of their pension is going to be applied. So in that context, with respect to the term disability, I don't think you can necessarily use the usual application in the usual sense of the cases that we handle versus this one. And it's the reason why you've filled out the form yourself, right? I mean, you've told Cesare how you want your pension handled in the event that you were to die as an employee of the county. And you're not going to benefit from that, but you're looking after your beneficiaries, your loved ones. So I see the context being different, and I don't think that you apply or need to apply the same standard of how we handle disability in the usual sense as we do in this sense. But, yeah.
Well, it's just
going to
First off, I appreciate everybody here on the board and their comments made, and it's made me think a lot. But, I think the heart of this discussion here is not the member, the recipient of the benefits. Let me clarify that. I'm trying to make a decision here. With that aside, I mean, obviously, ultimately, we want to maximize the benefits for the beneficiary. You don't want to rob them of anything they're entitled to. Harvey mentioned earlier, though, whenever we make a decision on whatever settlement we choose, we're gambling, right? I could be wrong on this, but before, it seems like we're giving an advantage to the member in this gamble.
I go back to the point I made earlier about whether or not we even need the form. Couldn't today I walk into CCSERA and just decide, you know, that in the future, if I were to die or not, my option settlement is going to be unmodified or modified, okay? And whatever happens between now and then, it's already been decided by me. It's a gamble I'll take. And I can live with that, or not live with it, but my beneficiaries can. But, again, going back to your point, Will, I think we're all very concerned about every member in our system, or not impartial, or partial rather, because of some financial advantage we want to have over them. We're just struggling with this principle here, this idea of what a disability is. When does the person become incapacitated permanently? And this thought about, the duration being as little as a nanosecond, we struggle with. And even on the condition, or at least today, you brought something I didn't think of, a suicide. What's the policy on that if somebody were to take their own lives and still survive but ultimately die? Does this form still have an effect on their beneficiaries? Or is suicide one of those things where we say, well, if you commit suicide, it wipes it out. I don't know. But that's I didn't think of that. I'm not sure how the board would sit on that. But this is my train of thought. I'm a little flustered. I have to confess. It's somewhat emotional. I'm trying to remain unemotional about this, but I feel strongly, too, as a board, we have to come to some consensus here on just this very issue. Whether we agree to just rubber stamp everyone and not bring it to the board again, so we have to go through all these motions, or we do define just exactly what this duration means to us as a board. We're the only 37 Act County in the states that's doing this, and I think it's important that the board going to continue to do it. We kind of establish a standard that we all agree to, to live by going forward. But anyway, I'll stop there.
Thank you for asking, Jerry.
Just a final comment, especially for the benefit of the individuals who might be listening to this tape at a later time. It's worth remembering that today's agenda item was a workshop, an educational workshop, and I think it was an opportunity for board members to hear presentations, to exchange information. This was not an agenda item to decide whether or not we were going to change something or modify something or stop something. If that came at a later date, it could come at a later date. So I'd like to thank the group for doing that, because I think you've achieved that. You've given us the opportunity to engage in a lively conversation and be better educated on the subject. Thanks.
John?
Well, there's time for one more. I'm not sure anybody quite responded to Will's point, why we're doing any of this. We had at least two of these cases, I would say, in the last year that I recall, and in both cases, I just found myself very uncomfortable being put in the position of having to decide whether 1 second or 3 seconds or whatever it might be is the right amount of time. And my own view was that the path we were on and the precedence that we had set, these are death benefits, these are not disability benefits, and we're miscalling it. For most of us, disability, we've talked enough about that today and in the past, that all have a fairly clear view of what a disability benefit is. It's something you pay to people who become disabled and can no longer work. That isn't this. It's a death benefit. If we want to make a death benefit permanent, it seems to me that's a perfectly appropriate thing to do, and we've clearly indicated that it's not a high-cost issue. Doesn't happen very often. But I want to see the board out of the world where we deal with 1 microsecond or 2 minutes or whatever and try and figure out which is what. So anyway, hopefully that will is. That's why I at least, and I think the board as a group, obviously speaking for myself, wanted this kind of workshop to try and pin down how we deal with this in the future to put ourselves and future boards out of this kind of two-second rule.
Before I get to that, Mr. Chairman, I thought it might be useful just to volunteer that when this was first brought to me 5 years ago or however long, my first question was, what's the duration? And I think that's still the question. So what I've been doing and what I will continue to do until somebody tells me different is to try to estimate, or if there's factual data that I can state with certainty, what the period of incapacity was, and leave the determination of whether that meets the definition to you all. Thank you, sir. I just wanted to make a couple comments. I asked for a workshop like this. I was very uncomfortable. One of the few times I actually left this chamber, for lack of a better term, emotionally shaken, just because I didn't think the appropriate venue to have it was when we had the application before us. So I want to say thank you to staff. I told Karen, and I'll state on the record, I thought this was one of the most helpful agenda item packets that I've had since I've been on this board. This was a topic I thought I understood, and there was so much more nuance that I learned from this that is helpful to me as a trustee, and I hope other trustees had a similar takeaway. In doing research for this meeting, I know this is totally anecdotal, but I went to about 10 Central Sand employees who I thought were very knowledgeable on the retirement system, and I can tell you a lot of them didn't know that they had that this form exists. Candace said, we put it in your new hire pack. It's just part of what you get, and so it's easy for them not to know. The ones who did know about this form thought that it was a rubber stamp, that if, for whatever reason, I die, this form gets invoked. And based on the pack, you know, there's a lot more to take in than just that. So I went to our most knowledgeable, in terms of pension, HR rep, and they thought the exact same thing. So there is an information gap out there that I think we need to address, or that not we need to, because this is operational, that I would hope that staff, you know, upon hearing some of these things, would do some more outreach and let people know what this is. You know, even little things like the name of the form is death during active membership. I don't think that does us any service in fighting this perception. I'm not one to wordsmith at all, but I think something to the effect of disability leading to death during active membership more accurately is a more accurate title for what this is, because it's not a rubber stamp. So I want to thank everyone for their patience with my calling on them. I thought it was everyone, you know, for the most part, everyone was very respectful, and I appreciate everyone's comments. So I'll get off my little thing. Karen, I know you had a few more slides left. Is there anything else you wanted to cover?
No, the last few slides list topics that I think for the most part have been discussed. This isn't an action item, but if there's any inclination to come back with something additional for the board or for the board providing any direction to staff to do anything different, we would love to be able to do that for you to address some of these concerns.
And Harvey, did you have anything?
If I may, for the board, I think we have Dr. Blink here. I think it would be useful to understand
fact that you're reviewing situations, what medical evidence do you look at to make a call on the duration issue or the conditions for her disability and death? Because that has come up. And, you know, one of the things that we've mentioned is the board should look at, it's not a rubber stamp, the board needs to make a disability determination, and it's going to rely on the medical examiners. So what does the medical examiner rely on in these situations to come to a conclusion or recommendation of the board?
Well, I believe I've done that in the reports I've submitted. So, for instance, if we have medical records showing that someone was hospitalized for X number of days or weeks prior to death, I'll address that. In the two cases, or I guess it's been three, where we had the unwitnessed cardiac event, and I basically explained that because there is this five-minute period from cessation of circulation until brain death, that it's inevitable that there was a period of disability. As to whether that meets the board's, Cicero's definition, it's out of my hands, but I can certainly deduce without any qualms at all that there was some finite period of incapacitation. And that, again, it's up to you. I'd be very happy to be given some guidance on where to draw that line. But without that, I merely can state the facts and hand it off.
Is there any case where you wouldn't find that there was some duration?
There always will be a duration. If you're standing next to a nuclear weapon and at the speed of light, the photons are destroying your brain, if the brain is 10 centimeters from top to top to bottom, in those 10 centimeters at the speed of light, it's 300 picoseconds pass. That's a real number. It's not measurable. At least I don't believe it is. Maybe it could be by wavelength disruptions. That probably would be. So, yes, it is measurable. So it's strictly a matter of policy determination of what duration you're talking about. When you get into these insanely fine gradations, I don't know what it means. So I can merely pass that along.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Rusty?
No, I was just going to ask the staff to come back to the board, but unless you want to use this presentation, some language that would define, again, more clearly in this case, what disability is, on-service disconnected disability, with a form 104, and or what death is. I mean, in this example here, the slide, give us two definitions, and we could really choose one or the other, or go with both. But and again, the board probably would have to decide on that. But could the staff be willing to explore some language, but that might help us establish a definition of what disability is in this case for 414 and death.
In cases where there was a natural cause of death that may appear to be, or the death may appear to be sudden?
Or unwitnessed?
Yes. We've had one of those that stands out to me, the unwitnessed varietal.
Unwitnessed.
So whenever we get a report back from Dr. Blank, you know, I'm trying to understand what you said earlier. You're thinking future reports, maybe just telling us how much you think the person might survive prior to death. And then leave it to us to decide whether that's enough time to consider it a disability. Is that what you said or meant to say earlier?
That's what I...
Instead of making the recommendation this person is disabled, just saying, you guys decide now if this person is disabled. I'll tell you how much I think that person lived up until the point of death.
I can tell you... I could either estimate or give you a pretty clear idea of what the duration of incapacity has been. Sometimes you're going to have to surmise in the event of an unwitnessed cardiac arrest. Then the surmise is that from the
when circulation stopped until brain function was completely dead, as per the neurology definition, must have been at least 4 minutes. And to total brain death, more like 10 or 20.
I'm just curious, aside, do you ever have to make this determination for anybody else than for C.C. Sarah's board?
I've never even heard of anybody doing this.
Okay.
Maybe it's arisen in some other venue, but I'm not aware of it.
All right. So in all fairness to Dr. Plank, I think we should get next to guidelines what we would consider a C.C. Sarah as. What is the duration? What is death? What's a disability? Yeah. He's...
isn't duration. It's just our standard of what we interpret disability. And if this is truly a disability benefit, that's where duration becomes perhaps relevant, or how we define disability. If, as John suggests, it's a death benefit that a member is entitled to by virtue of their death and no longer being able to work, then we perhaps should change it to that and make sure we factor that into all our actuarial assumptions, or determine whether that might change who would be eligible for this benefit.
Any other final thoughts? Okay, seeing none. Dr. Blank, thank you so much for your time and appearance.
Thank you.
Thank you for everyone's participation in this matter. I think we can all agree we should take a break, and we will reconvene for item 5 and